Curtis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Curtis.
Let's see. I think we're going to have plenty of time to see the Super Bowl tonight. I was a little nervous coming up here, and so I asked Sam about being nervous and speaking. And he said, just talk to me. So I talked to my dad, and he said, just pretend everybody's naked. So I said, if I got to talk to Sam while he's sitting there naked, I'm in bad shape than I thought I was. So anyway, yeah, I have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and this is my home group. And if it wasn't for this home group and this program, I wouldn't be standing here tonight a year and 5 months. Of some of the roughest time of my life, but some of the best time of my life too. And I'm gonna tell you what it was like, what happened, how it is now. I was born and raised on a farm in Orange County. My mom and dad, they're both Christians. I was raised in a Christian home. Neither one of them drank. They didn't beat on me. They didn't talk bad to me. I really had it made as a kid. Let's see, I guess when I was 4 or 5 years old, I remember something started happening to me that was a little different from some of the other kids. I started kind of having this feeling of maybe a little fear of other people. And it wasn't people that I felt comfortable around. It was people that I felt intimidated by, or things of that nature. I was starting on this building this ego at a young age, and so I did stuff starting at that young age to hide that fear from people. I guess when I was a kid, you know, I would show off around people that intimidated me a little bit, you know, whether it be an athletic guy or a good-looking lady or girl or whatever. I would, you know, if we're riding motorcycles, I'd jump the highest, you know. And I hear that a lot around AA. I got a little older, I got into sports, and even in sports, I would go just a little bit farther because I didn't want anybody to see me fail. You know, I was scared to death for somebody to see me fail. I remember one time I was playing middle school baseball. It was actually before middle school. And they had me on first base, and a little blooper was hit out between first and second. I made this dive and catch. Everybody was clapping, and there was this good-looking little girl sitting right behind the dugout, behind the fence there. And I kind of liked her. So I come jogging back in, and everybody was hollering and cheering me on. And she said, good catch, Curtis. And I said, I know. You know, that's just... You know, I could have said anything. I still don't know why I said that. And that's the last time she ever talked to me to this day. But, you know, I was always trying to be somebody I wasn't. I was cocky. And that fear was making me cocky. And that was really leading me to a place I really didn't want to be. I never saw that till after I got here this past year. You know, all these things building up to that. And so I was definitely an overachiever. I was good at wrestling, baseball. I was in the honor society. I was going into high school with straight A's. And like I say, anybody that I wasn't intimidated by or didn't. I don't know, I didn't have to feel like I had to be some big show in front of. I got along with them fine, but it was those people that intimidated me, made me feel that fear, that's when I really had to do that overachieving stuff. Man, I would go to no end to be the best, and I wanted you to know I was the best. So, I guess I was about a junior in high school. I think I was about 14 years old. I tell you something else is, I started school a year early, so I was always the youngest. There was one girl that was just a couple days younger than me, and I was small and the youngest of my class. I really should have waited probably another year to start school, but the way my birthday fell, it was right on the line, so my parents sent me on anyway. They probably had it with that ego already. So, I think that made a little difference too in how I acted, you know, always wanting to be something I wasn't. So I hung around with some older friends, probably my junior year in high school. Maybe I was 15, but these guys were getting their driver's license and stuff, and I was wanting to go with them. And my mom, she fought that every step of the way. She didn't want me leaving with them older guys. And man, it just kept building up and building up and building up. And finally one night, my best buddy, he had his driver's license. We finally talked her in to let me go with him. And I was going to stay the night at his house. And a week prior to that, his sister had been married, and they had this big party for his sister. And there was a bunch of stuff left over, beer and champagne and stuff like that. So, I think we're getting ready to identify. We got in his basement and got into that leftover champagne. And that was my first drink. And we drank that stuff until we were falling around on the floor and... they were sick, and I was dancing around like I was floating, man. I loved it. I wasn't quite sure the feeling I was having, but I can remember just loving that numbness. And finally, I got sick, and he got sick. I think we all got sick on that old champagne. Whew. But the next day, everybody got up, and that would be my first hangover. And I remember them guys, they were... my best buddy, he was still sick, man. He was done. And I remember I asked him, "Where's that champagne at? I'm gonna try a little bit more of that stuff." So I remember that like it was yesterday. And after that experience, that opened up a whole new world for me. That became a every weekend thing. And that relieved that pressure off of me to have to be somebody I wasn't, you know, around these different people, because I could, when I was drinking, you know, I could be, that was me. And I could be cocky, I could be whatever I wanted, and I felt good about it. I didn't have to hide it anymore. Here recently, I took my mom out for dinner, which we hadn't done in years, and we were talking, and she had told me that she remembered that night also. And she said, "Curtis," she said, "I feel like I felt like that night you left out of there that I had lost you." She said, "Something in you changed." And she said, "From that point forward," she said, I feel like like you were gone, you know. You weren't the same son that I had. And I never realized that. It was all about me. It was always about Curtis. And I never even paid it any mind. And into high school and stuff, things started getting worse with me drinking, like I say, instead of every weekend. Then I was doing it during the week. And the guys would come pick me up, and she would stand in front of the door and try to, you know, hold her arms up and try to block me from leaving with them. And I would just push her out of the way and go on, or or cuss at her or whatever I had to do. And most of the time, my dad would be working. You know, he worked till dark on the farm. And I would get on out of there before he got there. And, man, we had some terrible screaming matches and fights with her trying to keep me in. And it was just too late. So let's see. I guess the first real trouble I got in caused by alcohol was I had this old boy ride me around one night. And he went into the C-Mart over there, Main Street on Orange. And he bought me a 12-pack of beer. And I didn't know it, but the Virginia ABC man was sitting across the road at the bank. And I guess they had been having a little trouble with that. So he waited till this guy bought me beer and came on out. And he waited until we went on up the road. And I asked him, I said, you know, what are you waiting for? Go on, hand me a beer. And he did. And when I turned that thing up, he hit the lights on us. So that was my first. He got contributed to the delinquency of minor and aiding and abetting, and I got drinking underage. So there me and my dad are up in court, and my dad's taking up for me. And little did he know it, this would be, you know, the start of an ongoing thing, him bailing me out of trouble. And he got a lawyer, and I got out of that deal with just a slap on the wrist. Seymour got shut down, and the other boy, I think he might have had to pull a day or two in jail for it. And it was all because of me. He wasn't no more worried about drinking than the man than me. So that was when I was around 16, 17. Let's see, I ran one of my dad's trucks up through a man's flower bed. It was this exotic flower bed. It was right in the curve of a turn. And I went up, knocked on the guy's door, and asked him, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, could I use the phone? And I was stuck. He said, yeah. So I called my buddy who lived down the road, and he came on up, and we had a chain hooked to the truck. About that time, a deputy rolled up. That guy, he must have smelled it on me when I used his phone, or just who uses the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning. So they took me on over to the Central Virginia Regional Jail and got me all suited up for a DUI. That was at 17. I got the DUI, got a suspended license, and went to VASAT. And that was nothing to me, that losing my license and stuff. Not once did I think drinking caused that. It was bad luck. I through the years, had gained this kind of talent. Being able to talk to people in a way that sometimes they didn't even understand. And what I mean is that my friends, I had one buddy I had, he loved me, and he loved being around me. He liked to laugh, but he didn't drink. And I kept him around. He was a good friend of mine, but he was my driver. And this other old boy, he was tough, and he liked to party like I liked to party, and he was a state champion wrestler, and he was one of my best friends also. And so when we get to these parties and stuff, and the big brawls and stuff broke out because of me running my mouth, I turned to my other buddy here, and he'd always take up for me. So I just had people all around me all the time, and I was always right in the center of attention, and I loved it. It ended up that one old boy, I thought I was using him. He ended up marrying my sister. I think maybe he was using me. But that was in later years. But so like I say, I lost my license, and I still had him driving me around, taking me anywhere I wanted to go. And my dad had this big old crew cab Chevrolet truck. He used to wax that thing about once a month, and I got the keys to that. And I went to a party, and I was leaving the party, and had a bunch of people in it. They liked that thing because we could get so many people in it. And I ran it down the driveway, and there was a big cliff hanging over Route 20, and I ran out on a tree, and that thing was hanging over Route 20. And I got out of it. It totaled it. I got out of it, and I walked on back up in the edge of the woods about 1,000 yards away, and I sat up on top of the hill, and all the people from the party were down there around it and everything. And soon I seen the blue lights. State troopers were everywhere. And I just sat up there and waited. I sat up there 5-6 hours. Finally, everybody left. And I remember walking on back down the hill. I see one of my old buddies standing there. He said, "I don't know how it happened, man." He said, "But we got so-and-so to pull that truck away from the road where it wasn't sitting over the road." And them cops talked and talked about it, and they didn't know where the driver was and this and that. And they must have had something else going on. And so many times this happened to me throughout my drinking that I didn't get in trouble when I should have. And he said, "They just left." And what I said was, "Did they take my cooler?" He said, "I got that for you, Curtis." He said, "You know, we're going to take your cooler." I said, "Well, thank you." We went home and partied the rest of the night. So I had totaled another truck before that. Between the DUI and this, another one of my dad's trucks. And the more I wrecked, the more he kept buying. And it was just getting it was getting crazy. I had no care whatsoever about any of his stuff and what I was doing, what I was tearing up. It was almost like the more I was tearing up, the crazier they thought I was, and the more I was driven by that. So I graduated from high school. By this time, since I had that first drink, I had gone from a National Honor Society to literally begging an English teacher to give me a 1 point so I could graduate high school. And when I got out of high school, I had been doing carpentry work in the summer times because I didn't like working on the farm. And I just didn't like working for family, really. And I wanted to blaze my own trail, I guess, so to speak. So I went to building houses with these guys, and not having a license, they would come get me every day and drop me off. So through all this drinking every night now, I don't know how, but I still always work really hard. I felt like that's one thing that I always had was I was driven to work hard somehow, wide open all day. And I drank all night, and I think it just gave me that little bit of a break I needed to get fired up back for the next night. I worked with guys who drank gin in the morning for breakfast and beer for lunch. And gin on the way home. I never did drink much gin, but I drank that beer with them. And on those hot summer days and stuff, we were busting tail working, and it didn't even feel like work to me. It was fun. But something happened, and that had all run out. I can't remember I had wrecked another vehicle or something. Anyway, my old man, he had enough of it, and he thought maybe a little change of scenery would do me some good. So he decided that, we both decided that if I could get into college, I would go ahead and try college. So I got in down at Bluefield, West Virginia. It was a Christian college. He said he went there. My mom went there, and they thought if I went to a Christian college, it helped straighten me out a little bit. So I said, you know, things are getting kind of wild, that I think that might do me some good. So I had one of my best friends drive me down. We let my parents take me down there so we could drink all the way down. And I got there, and I think within a day, maybe 2 days, at this Christian college, I had, found the people that like to drink, and found the party, And in 2 days, I didn't even know what a Christian college looked like. They had one fraternity. They had a bunch of fraternities there, but they had one fraternity that was like, they were labeled the party fraternity. The rest of them were Christian fraternities. I mean, this school, you got to go to church too on Sundays and Wednesdays as credits. So I pledged for this fraternity, and that may be one of the roughest things I ever went through, but I remember they said, this is a Christian school, but you know, this, I don't know, I better not talk about that. Anyway, I got in with these guys, and we partied from daylight till dark. I did make enough time to squeeze in a few classes, and I had this one English teacher. She was a young girl, and she really liked me, and I think she saw the potential I had, but she also knew what I was doing. And I can remember laying in bed all hungover, and we had an answering machine there, and that phone ringing. I knew who it was, and she'd say, "Curtis, this is so-and-so." She said, "You coming to class today?" I just let it ring. You know, people cared about me. They really cared about me. But I just wouldn't let anything interfere with, come between me and my partying. So that went on for a while. I didn't pass too many classes. I only got in real trouble down there one time. We were at a bar down there at Bluefield, and I came out of the bar and I had brought the pitcher of beer with me. And when I walked out on the front porch, there were some cops standing outside. It was about closing time, and one of them seen me. So I took off running, and when I took off running, one of them took after, he came after me, chased me down, So they took me to jail, gave me a drunk in public. The trouble was, down at Bluefield, West Virginia, I didn't know anybody but the few guys I was partying with in that fraternity. And for some reason, they wouldn't let me use the phone to call my dad, my old bailout man. So I sit down there for 4 or 5 days in that dungeon. And I was glad to hear after, I think it was 4 or 5 days, one old guard's come back here and got me, and I went out, and he said your dad's on the phone. He's looking for you. He hadn't heard anything from me. He called down there looking for me, and one of the boys in my roommate had answered the phone and said, "Well, I think he's in jail. I don't know. We ain't seen him." So he called a bail bondsman. This old boy, this bail bondsman, he didn't know me from Adam. When he got up in front of the judge, and he's telling the judge how I come from this great family, and I was scared. I ran like a deer, and this wasn't my fault, And there again, somebody else is bailing me out. And so they give me a little, I think 40 hours of community service. I was cleaning up alleys down in Bluefield, West Virginia, wine miles and stuff. And I kind of liked that because I got to work. I missed work. And after I got done with that community service, about a week later, the town of Bluefield, West Virginia, called me and offered me a job. And to tell you the truth, at that point, I should have took it. So anyway, that was my second year. That was the end of my second year in college. And the following year, I had one more elective, and then I had to start on my degree. And they said that you're going to have to take a public speaking class. And I said, "That's not happening. There's got to be a way around it." And see, without that drinking, I mean, there's no way I could stand up in front of a bunch of people and talk. And I knew I couldn't, and I knew they would catch me if I tried. So I opted not to go back to college. I came on back home. My dad had a rental house there on the farm, and he let me stay in it for free. And, you know, a couple weeks, that was party central. So I met this girl who lived just down the road, and I had wrecked one more vehicle pretty bad down on the farm, and I said, maybe if I get with this girl and get married, this is going to change me. And so that's what I did. I got married. And that was kind of a pattern for me, like college and getting married. And that's when I was always trying to fill this hole I had with something. I thought, if I do this, you know, and things will be better. If I do that, things will be better. The reality was, I never really had looked at my drinking. So I married her, and I built a house there on the farm, and I got a job building these barns with this company in Culpeper. And it was a bunch of hardworking guys. You got paid. They give you so many hours to build a building, and if you did it before those hours were up, you got bonus. So that was right up my alley, man. Drink all night, work like heck all day, and get paid extra for it. But we had to work out of town a lot. And somewhere in there, I hate even talking about this, but I would drink till, you know, I got to wet in the bed a lot. And I don't know, you would think that somebody like me would put two and two together, but it just never. And we would go from state to state, putting these buildings up, and from town to town, and stay in these hotels. And not only did I, you know, wet the bed in every state, I wet the bed in every hotel I ever stayed in. I remember my foreman telling the lead man, they used to ride in the front, he said, you know, Curtis like a damn old dog marking his territory. So you would think that I would put it together, but it never occurred to me I had a drinking problem. I loved it. So that job was going good. I worked there 5 or 6 years, and then they started slowing down. I had a kid. I actually had two kids, and I was the newness of that job had wore off, and the kids were they were keeping me at home at night. You know, I had gave up. I was drinking at home. I decided that I needed a little something else, so I decided to get my pilot's license. I said, this will cure me, because I surely, you know, I can, I'll get all interested in this flying. It'll take some of this time away. And so that's what I did. My dad had an airplane. I often tell the joke that, you know, all these vehicles my dad's I wrecked, when I asked him for his airplane keys, he says, time for you to go to AA. It wasn't exactly like that, but he was a little worried. So what did I do? I got a flight instructor who liked to party just like I did. He liked to drink. We fly that thing all over North Carolina, everywhere. It was a good excuse for me. You know, I'm learning to fly, and we were hitting bars and stuff at nighttime. And I started feeling, I never flew drunk, but I flew hungover several times, and I don't know, that fear of flying, when you're hungover, you know, I had a fear of flying when I was like that. I didn't enjoy it, and it wasn't filling that hole by any means. If anything, it was making me more and more paranoid about what I was doing. And so I kind of gave up flying, and somewhere along the way, my wife and I had lost something, if it was ever even really there. But I developed this. I started developing. You know, it was something missing with me and her. So I started trying to figure it out. The more I tried to figure it out, the more I drank. Because when I drank, I would. You know, it wouldn't worry him as bad. I could sleep at night. And I don't want to talk too much about that, but But I have to because it's kind of a what happened. And we were married 14 years, and for the last probably 5 or 6 years, we were just drifting apart more and more. And I couldn't put my hand on what was wrong. And she liked for me to drink. And I don't really know how to explain it, but it was just something missing. So I drank more and more over that. She had said that maybe we could just live together as friends. And so you take somebody like me who's who I've already told you I'm full of fear of other people, and you know, real sensitive. I really don't feel much physical pain at all. For some reason, I'm blessed with that. But what physical pain I don't feel is doubled up on the inside. Those matters of the heart now, shoo. And I never thought I'd feel about a woman like I did that. It was driving me insane. I just could not get a handle on it. And so, like I say, I was drinking on the porch. I was drinking this and that. And finally, we started talking about splitting up. My kids have, by this time, got up to be about the age of 10 and 7, maybe 11 and 8. And she was doing these things to kind of push my buttons, to keep me crazy, I guess is the best way to put it. And I decided to take my kids for a four-wheel ride there on the farm one day. And I said to them, things just aren't going good. They could sense it between me and your mom. And I said, I hadn't even talked to her about this. I said, I think there may be a good chance that we're going to have to split up. And I could tell, you know, they were heartbroken. And I had never had to deal with that because my parents, they never even fought in front of me. And my oldest son, they sat there for a few minutes, and he said, Dad, do you think that maybe if you laid off the drinking a little bit, it would help? And that's when I started putting two and two together a little bit. And Sam, I've heard him say that you have to have some direct hits to get you to where you're going. And that was one of them. So these other things that was going on between me and her, I thought maybe something else was going on and this and that. But I stayed in such a fog that I couldn't figure it out. And finally, I just couldn't take it anymore. I went to the doctor one day. I took off work. I told the guy that I'm in business with. We started our own business about 5 years after. It was me and that foreman that was talking about it. Started our own business. We've been in business about 11 years now, building custom homes and stuff. He came to my house and he said, man, you're in bad shape. I said, I'm going to take off today. I'm going to see the doctor and tell him what's going on. And so I went and told him, and doctor said, I don't know what to do about you and your wife. He said, but you definitely, I think, have a drinking problem. That is hit number two. He said, I'm gonna give you some antidepressants and some anxiety pills and this and that, and I want you to think about going to AA. And I had never really thought about AA. I had never really thought about having a drinking problem. And I thought about that, and a couple days later, I was taking them old pills, and stuff was just built up on me. I mean, I felt like I had an elephant on me. I was, you know, drinking morning and night, and I drank about 20 beers, and it was about 102 degrees. We had set trusses that day, taking them pills, and I went home, and I laid down in bed. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I had this feeling that like I was laying on my back in the water, and I was sinking, and I could see the sunlight like fading away. I thought I was drowning, and I had got up the next morning sick. I was throwing up every morning before work. I'd been doing that for 6 months. She would leave for work, and I would go outside and throw up anyway. I called my dad, and he had been talking to this lady that was in AA, and she said, what you need to do with your son, if he won't go, she said, you need to take him by the hand and take him down there. And that's what he did. And that was August the 5th, 2011. Me and my old man went down to the graveyard at Rapidan. And that's what happened to get me there. And by that time, I had worked step one. I was powerless over alcohol. And actually, I was powerless over, you know, pretty much everything. And I had talked to several people there at that meeting, and they were telling me to keep coming back, and I got some numbers and stuff, and I was so desperate that I actually went on and called a couple of them and kept going back to that meeting, and started going to the big book meeting down at Rapidan on Thursday nights. And by that time, I was working step two. I was looking for something to restore my sanity, because I wasn't getting it at home. I had this obsession with me and my wife, and what had happened was she was my higher power. And it wasn't, her being my higher power wasn't working for me. It was killing me, you know. And if things weren't right with her, I wasn't right. So I kind of switched over to AA as my higher power. And I was really looking for them, you know, looking into them to show me the way. And so I went about 7 months and without drinking and going to AA. And I had started working the steps with a guy. And she packed up and left. And it says in there, you know, I can't remember pages of 99, but sometimes that a man will have to make it on his own, and it's possible. I didn't think it was possible. I was so drawn to her that I really felt like maybe suicide or something would be a good option, but I knew I couldn't go back to that fog I was in. Something, I guess, as the grace of God, telling me I couldn't drink. And I can't explain how powerful that is. I don't know if y'all know anything about farming, but if you take a cow and a calf, and you try to wean that calf off his mama when he's young, you can do it. But if you raise him up till he's 200 or 300 pounds, and try to take his mama away, he'll tear down every damn fence on the farm trying to get to it. He's crazy. I've seen it happen. I've done it myself. That's the way I was with her. Now, I wasn't chasing her down or anything, but I was insane. And in that 7 months, I think I've been here 3 months, I joined this home group right here. And these guys got around me like a huddle. And some of these old rainy days when I couldn't drive nails, they'd call me and check on me, because they were some of the days that I was alone and was really having some time to think. And I shared some stuff with them guys that I would never share with anybody else in my life, and they shared things with me that that got me through those days. I mean, some personal stuff that related to my situation. And I'm grateful for that. And I hope I can do that with somebody else. And so, at this meeting, I was looking for a way to break this obsession. That's what it is. It was an obsession with alcohol And I had quit that and came to AA, and now the obsession had moved, you know, on to her. And I heard Sam speak up here one night when he got his chip, what he was doing and this and that. And I heard it, but I didn't hear it. But what I did hear was what he said at the end. He said, and by doing this, he said, I'm free as a bird. And I said, man, I've got to have some of that. I do. I want to be free from this worry and this torment and this pit I'm in. And so I asked Sam to sponsor me. And we started going through the steps. And like I say, I was got down to my inventory. And this whole time, it was my wife's fault. She's pushing my button. She's doing this. She's doing that and doing this. And I got step four, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper. And Sam says, now you know, look at this. And I looked at it, and it was still her fault. But you ain't looking at it right. Man, we went over that thing, I don't know how many times. We still go over it once in a while. I did not want to look at that four step. That inventory and the part I had played in it. Sure, she was an emotionally abusive person. She is. But I was allowing it to happen. And I was drinking and letting things slide. And the more I looked at it, the more clear it started becoming of my role in this and the bigger it got. And how I had set the ball rolling. You know, if I hadn't been drinking, I probably wouldn't have married a person like that. So, as much as I didn't want to admit it, it was mainly all this stuff crashing down on me was mainly my fault. And I was ready to have it removed. And that's what we did. We prayed about it, and I did what I thought was a thorough as I could do. Every once in a while, things pop up, four step, and things started getting a little better. I had some amends to make to some different people besides her. My mother was one I definitely had to make, and it was probably my main one. And she. I often say I don't like making amends because that fear comes back that I used to have, and I just don't like making amends. But I'll tell you this one with her, and I went to her and said, you know, I regret the things I've done, and is there any way I can make it right? It's basically what I said to my mother, and it was very emotional. She shook me and she was crying. She said, don't you ever apologize to me. And I said, well, you know, thank you, Mom. And she later told me, she said, you know, I felt like I had lost you. And I knew you were serious when you did it. She said, now I feel like I might have you back. So that was just one of the amends I had made. And her and I now, we went for years without even talking. And now her and I, like I say, we have a relationship that money can't even buy. And it's just getting better and better every day. And so my last three steps here was to stay on top of this obsession, believing that something ain't true. I have to do my step 10 every day. I'll tell you how that works real quick. Is I call my sponsor once a day, every day, and he'll say hello. I'll say hello, and I say, I ain't got no amends to make today. Or I'll say, this is what happened. What do you think? That's step 10 for me. I'm taking my personal inventory. And then on 11, I usually do page 86, and I look through there the things I need to ask myself at night. Have I been dishonest? Is there something I need to tell somebody once? You know, do I have any resentments? We know that resentments aren't aren't for us, for normal men. And then in the morning, I ask God to show me what He would have me be for that day. And that helps a lot, and I used a book for that for a long time, or for a lot of time. I wouldn't say a long time. But now I found that during the day, by practicing that morning and night, I can pick up on little stuff like that that I never would even pay any attention to. I was like, wait a minute now, you need to back out of this, Curtis, because you're getting ready to get your butt in trouble. And I don't like calling Sam, telling him what's going on. So, on the last step, step 12, is we've had a spiritual awakening. And what that is for me is a personality change. And I've definitely had a personality change. Definitely. I never dreamed that I could stand up here and talk in front of a room full of people. I have talked to people that I can't even look in the eyes and carry on a conversation with them now. My business partner, he's like, man, what in the world happened to you? We get done a job, I used to get in the truck and was gone. He'd be left standing there talking to the customer, and now I'm trying to shake a man's arm off, you know? And so I'm really grateful for that. And I work with alcoholics daily, talk to different guys in the home group, and help them any way that I possibly can. And all that step 10 and 11 and 12, what that does is keep the problems from building up on me. Keeps me free. And that's a good feeling. And I can get right back where I was real quick. But if I practice that, it keeps me free. So I think I'm about done. I will say this, is that I think that God and AA, that I think that I don't know how to say it. I think that what was killing me in the end is probably going to save me. And if we can carry that message to one person, then we've done our job, I think. So, thanks for letting me share.